Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. The author of our Issues Etc. book of the month for April, Dr. Paul Meyer, joins us here for the first half hour. We're going to talk about the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. In the second half hour of this hour, Dr. Judith Reisman from the Institute for Media Education joins us to talk about an update on the Kinsey Institute. You remember the Kinsey Report, don't you? Oh, what is this? What's the line from that song? According to the Kinsey Report, every average man, you know, much prefers his lovey-dovey to court when the temperatures are low. I remember that song. Well, the Kinsey Institute, which has come in for a lot of heat, they're trying to rebuild its reputation. We'll see what Judith Reisman has to say about that particular turn of events in the second half hour. And then in the third hour of the program, Dr. Peter Scarer joins us. We're going to be talking with him about the passion account of Jesus according to St. Luke. We'll be talking about that night in the upper room in the third hour of Issues Etc. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Paul Meyer is a regular guest here on Issues Etc. He's professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and he's author of several books, including In the Fullness of Time and our Issues Etc. book of the month for April, the very first Easter. Dr. Meyer, welcome back.
Good to be with you again, Todd.
Let's jump right into the crucifixion, if we could. What did the typical Roman crucifixion entail? The account seems to begin with Jesus carrying his own cross out to the place of execution.
Well, the crucifixion penalty was a very advertising form of death. It was very, very public. The whole idea was to make it a model, an exemplar, a warning. Don't ever do what this fellow did who was hung up in the cross, because you'll suffer a penalty exactly like his if you don't watch out. That's the reason they had the titulus or title over head in Jesus' case, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. And the Romans used the term king for the last time in 509 B.C., and they never used that term again because they hated it. They were regiphobic. They hated the term king. Even later emperors who had more power than any king would never call themselves rex in Latin or king. That's why Pontius Pilate, who didn't want to crucify Jesus, had to have a stated basis, a legal basis for executing him, and so he uses that term king. It was a very horrible punishment. Cicero calls it the worst of all tortures. It was invented in Persia about the 500s B.C., and then the Phoenician Punics picked it up, living in North Africa, whenever their admirals or generals lost a sea battle or land battle. They were often treated to crucifixion as a result. In the case of the Romans, it was mainly the penalty for runaway slaves, radicals who wanted to overthrow the government, pirates, brigands, people like that.
Now, they had other forms of execution that were less time-consuming, obviously.
Yes, and they certainly did. If you were a Roman citizen, you were and guilty of some terminal punishment, you were simply decapitated, as St. Paul was. You see, he was a Roman citizen, so that would happen in his case, whereas St. Peter, when he got to Rome, would be crucified as a member of this cult, as they called it.
We've seen different pictures, Dr. Meyer, Jesus suspended from the cross with ropes, Jesus suspended from the cross with a little seat to sit on, Jesus suspended from the cross only by nails. What does the account tell us? What's the most we can say according to the account of the Gospels?
Well, it's possible to say all of the above, but there's no question that that nails were involved. I mean, that's very clear from the Gospel of John when Thomas wants to put his hands in Jesus, when Jesus offers to have Thomas put his hand in his thigh and the nails and the feet and the hands. And so many critics have doubted this, by the way. For instance, the late Bishop Jim Pike, you recall, in the Anglican Church, who became something of a postgraduate Christian, as he called himself, whatever that means, his last theological treatise was to suggest that Jesus could never have been nailed to the cross, as John's Gospel claims, because the human flesh is too fragile, to hang on to a cross with a nail. In the victim's agony, he would pull his hand up over the head of the nail and fall off, and so on. Supposedly, they tried it on somebody, but it didn't work. I don't know who would have lent himself to this wonderful experiment. But in any case, this is now old hat, because this doubt is old hat, because in 1968, they accidentally were doing a housing development at Givat HaMivtar in northeastern Jerusalem, and by accident they scraped open the side of a hill. 35 ossuaries, or stone bone chests, were found inside, very much like the one that was discovered in the case of James, possibly the brother of Jesus, you recall, last fall. That made big news. In any case, one of these stone bone boxes was opened. The bones inside belong to Yochanan ben Hagakol. Nobody really knows his significance other than his bones being found. But this fellow was crucified. It's the proof positive. His shin bones are broken just below the kneecap, indicating that this was a common method of terminating people on the cross. They did it to the malefactors crucified on either side of Jesus on Good Friday, as you recall. And 7 inches worth of iron spike is still lodged in his heel bones. Clearly, it was late in the day. They couldn't pull this particular spike out because as they were hammering it in originally into an olive wood cross, it encountered a knot, and they kept pounding on it, and it turned the tip of the spike into a fish hook. And so they just hauled the whole affair down. And so this was proof that they certainly did nail people to the cross. Others, I don't know, they might have saved the metal and just tied them, it's hard to say.
And the breaking of the bones, this is something that figures in an important way into the verifying the death of Jesus on the cross. What was the purpose of that particular, I mean, beyond just the cruelty, I guess?
Whole idea was to remove a platform from which the body could stand or support itself in order to make the diaphragm normal breathing work. If you remove this particular platform, breathing becomes terribly difficult. And you finally asphyxiate is what you do. If you have no place to keep breathing and you're just hanging there and there's no support, and of course that support would be removed once you break a person's legs, then death would ensue in a short time. So asphyxiation is really the final reason for death by crucifixion.
How long is it estimated that it took people to die by crucifixion?
Oh, there are various times. Josephus, for example, that eloquent first century Jewish historian, mentions that in the siege of Jerusalem, three of his friends were accidentally crucified, or rather, Josephus then interceded with his boss, General Titus, and asked that his friends be spared. They'd been on the cross for 3 days. Two of them died anyway, but one did survive after being on the cross 3 days.
And it was definitely a form of, it wasn't just a form of torture, but it was definitely intended to lead to the death of the person who was being crucified.
Oh, certainly. Oh, it was absolutely terminal. Absolutely terminal.
We've had some listeners email us in the course of this week asking some questions in advance, and here's one that seems to fit at this point. Thane from Spring Valley, California asks this question: what role, if any, did the honor and shame-based society of that time play in Jesus' death and resurrection? And I think he's talking about the basic valuing of honor and despising of shame in the culture.
Well, the whole idea is it's a degree of punishment that is reserved only for the bottom rung of society. Roman citizens, of course, were totally exempt from this, again, worst of all tortures, as Cicero put it. And the whole idea, again, is a totally negative ad. Don't do what this miscreant did. You will otherwise get hung up like that. And so there's a shame or honor isn't really involved here. It's simply a negative ad, a very, very negative ad.
You've mentioned before in conversations that the crucified were generally stripped completely naked. They were allowed absolutely no dignity. And yet most of the depictions we see of Christ crucified, everybody involved in the scene, including the thieves, all are given at least a loincloth to wear. Is that accurate?
You know, I think it's accurate. Even if it were not accurate, I can't see a Christian artist painting Jesus au naturel in those particular areas of his body, for goodness sake. But you have to remember again that there isn't any one single standard the modus operandi when it comes to crucifixion. Some of the crosses themselves were different. Some were X-shaped crosses. Some were the typical Christian cross, in which it's called the crux immissa, which stands up, and then over the victim's head there's a space of about a foot or two to hang a sign. Others were maybe tau-shaped crosses, T-shaped crosses. If you didn't have to have the sign on top, you could maybe put it under his feet, you understand? So there are different methods of crosses, different processes in attaching the victim to the cross, nails or ropes or both, that's sometimes done as well. And so there's no standard procedure here.
The place where Jesus was crucified, one of the gospel writers tells us, was near the city. What do we know of its location?
Oh, yes. The whole idea, again, if this is a negative advertisement, you want as many people to see it as possible. And the traditional site for Golgotha is just outside the Joppa Gate, or Jaffa Gate as it's called, in West Jerusalem. This is where the great Church of the Holy Sepulchre was first erected by Constantine, the first Christian emperor, 326 A.D., and the subsequent churches, the Crusader churches, built over the base of that particular structure are visible to the present day yet. In fact, the whole Church of the Holy Sepulchre is. So the traditional site, very near the Joppa Gate in the west central part of Jerusalem, is most probably the place where Golgotha stood. And it was directly on the Joppa Road, it was called. You come out the west gate of the old city of Jerusalem and you head straight to the port of Joppa, and therefore it's at a very prominent, visible intersection in terms of the road system.
One of the gospel accounts tells us that when the soldiers came to remove Jesus from the cross or to break the legs of the crucified, they marveled that he was already dead. Did Jesus die in an unusually short amount of time?
Yes, he did, as a matter of fact, but there's an explanation for that. You have to remember, though, the Gospels do not give us every detail on what happened to Jesus during Holy Week. And very, very clearly, on Thursday night, after he had been condemned by the Sanhedrin, he was tortured through much of the night, and probably more so than we even have written in the Gospels, because this made him very, very weak by the time Friday morning comes along. And there's the tedious business of going through two or three trials, really, you know, two before Pilate there, and then Herod Antipas's court, and then back again. And then after all his horrible mistreatment at Pilate's command. Again, not that Pilate was a sadist. He's trying to win sympathy from the crowd so that Jesus will at least come off with his life. And what happened was that Jesus got the worst of both in that case. He got the horrible flagellation, which the Romans called a fate next door to death. And so he's mistreated in that fashion. So he doesn't have even the physical ability to lift a 60-pound cross beam. Again, he didn't drag the whole cross to Calvary. It was a case of just the cross beam with the hole in the middle, so that you could then mortise that over a vertical stake at Golgotha that would continue standing. He couldn't even hold that cross beam. And they had to have Simon of Cyrene in North Africa, as you recall, a bystander, take the cross from him. So that shows he's in a terribly weakened condition to begin with when they first nail him to the cross, and that's why he can't last more than 3 hours.
Another listener writes from Minneapolis, John, what day did Jesus die, and how do we account for 3 days and three nights?
That's a familiar question, and there are so many people today who are trying to redo Holy Week. I think they've got a Maundy Tuesday and a Good Wednesday instead of Thursday and Friday. And I really think that if you examine the biblical records, the Gospels, very carefully, you notice that our traditional week is about accurate. Everybody knows, of course, that Jesus rose the first day of the week. That would be Sunday. That's the reason we celebrate Easter on Sundays. And the idea is that this is the Passover festival, which was the day before. And so the traditional idea of Jesus being on the cross on Good Friday is accurate. Now, how do we explain that famous statement, the famous objection, I should say, that we have not three full 24-hour days between Friday and Sunday? Actually, it's more like 36 hours. Well, the answer, the traditional answer, is still the best one, is that in Jewish reckoning, a fraction counts for the whole. The Jew would not say that a person went on a journey 3.5 days. He would say he went on a journey through a 4-day period. It's called the inclusive method. The fraction counts for the whole. Makes some sense. Okay, how do you pour 3.5 pails of water? How many buckets are involved? 4, right? And so this obviously is the inclusive method of reckoning, and so part counts for the whole. Friday is a very short day in death. Jesus dies mid-afternoon, and he is in the grave by sundown, which is the beginning of another day. So you have only 3 or 4 hours on Friday. Then you've got a full 24-hour day on Saturday, sundown Friday to sundown Saturday, because according to the Old Testament, days began in the evening, you recall. And day number 3 is sundown Saturday till sun up, or 6 a.m. or whenever dawn happened on Sunday morning. So there's your 3 days.
So we're really talking about, by the reckoning of the ancient world, over the course of 3 days.
Right.
But not a full, whatever it would be, 72 hours or whatever.
No, that's right, not 72 hours, right.
All right, another question from John in Minneapolis. What does Dr. Meyer think of the swoon theory? And I'll ask you to explain that.
Well, this is a familiar naturalistic explanation for how the resurrection could happen. It didn't happen, according to the swoon theory. Jesus only fainted on the cross. Maybe he was given some sort of narcotic or so, and with that vinegar, and therefore he resembled a person dying, but didn't really die. And then the cool of the tomb, since he only fainted, he came back slowly with his strength, and ta-dam, there's your resurrection. Now, obviously, this fails totally, because the Romans were grimly efficient about death after crucifixion. You know, their batting average for death after crucifixion was like 1,000. Even in these human demolition derbies in the Roman Colosseum and elsewhere, where you had butchery, you know, by the hundreds in gladiatorial combat, between every act, shall we say, there's a fellow dressed like Pluto who would dance among the bodies with a red-hot rod tip, and he would then poke each body, and if it flinched at all, a pike would go right through the heart. The Romans didn't let anybody escape. And this is the reason for the executioner's gesture at Golgotha. You recall they didn't break Jesus' legs because he was clearly, obviously dead. But just to make absolutely certain, this fellow lances Jesus' side with his pike. And out flowed blood and water, which showing that the death had already occurred and plasma separation had taken place.
And also, given the fact that that Pilate gives permission for the body to be taken down, he would hardly have left an execution unfinished.
Of course not. That's right.
Let's talk a bit about the burial before our time runs out here. What was the intent of placing him, Joseph of Arimathea, placing him immediately in the tomb with very little preparation?
Well, the reason for that is the rule that is observed in Israel to the present day, even as we speak. In Israel, if a person dies, he is buried that evening of the very day that he died. No long freezing the body or embalming or anything else. And that's the rule to the present day yet. And it comes from Hebrew law in the Old Testament. And so, therefore, they had to have Jesus' body off the cross and in the grave by sundown. Because the next day is the Sabbath. Sabbath day can't do any work.
And the tomb itself, you have mentioned several times in previous conversations, having been to the site that is purported to be the sepulcher. Tell us about it.
Well, today it's quite disappointing for pilgrims who come to Jerusalem. I think they expect to see, you know, Roman soldiers still milling around the city, and maybe, you know, an apostle available to sign their King James Bibles or something like that. And obviously things have changed across 2,000 years. And so the site of Golgotha, that used to be outside the city walls of Jerusalem, is now very much near the center of the much enlarged city. And therefore it has been built and rebuilt and destroyed and rebuilt so many times that today it kind of offends Western tastes in terms of the garish lanterns hanging around it and the icons and whatever else. And whenever I take a group to the Holy Land, I usually say, look, set your eyes. Don't be turned off by this bric-a-brac. Just remember that in terms of longitude and latitude on Earth, this is most probably where it happened 2,000 years ago. Now, there is a rival site called the Garden Tomb, which is north of Jerusalem, outside the Damascus Gate, and it's a beautiful place to visit, and it's much more likely that this would be Golgotha, and I should say the Joseph's Tomb area, in terms of the visual impression, but it has no historical significance.
And the method of burial here, was this intended, had Jesus not risen from the dead, was this intended to be his final resting place? They would close the tomb and have nothing more to do
with it? No, not his final resting place. What happened between 20 B.C. and 70 A.D., during that 90-year period, the Jews practiced the second burial system, which involved ossuaries. What does this mean? These are these stone bone chests in which a deceased person's bones would be gathered a year or two after he was put in a sepulcher, kind of a space-saving way to bury people. When the flesh had decayed from the bones, they'd gather the bones that remained and put them in these bone boxes. And they practiced this only during that 90-year period. And so Jesus was actually in the first stage of the second burial system. If it hadn't been for Easter, they'd have come a year later and gathered Jesus' bones and put him into an ossuary, the very kind of ossuary that was announced in the case of Jesus' half-brother, perhaps, James, the Just of Jerusalem, which was announced to the world last October. And then 10 years before that, the great Caiaphas ossuary was discovered. We have the actual bones of the high priest who indicted Jesus before Pontius Pilate on Good Friday morning, Joseph Caiaphas. That has been an accurate and very, very authentic discovery of major significance.
Dr. Paul Meyer, we leave in the cheerful hope of the resurrection. We leave our story at this point and talk to you again at some future point about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Thank you very much for being our guest.
Good to be with you again, Todd. Blessed Easter.
Dr. Paul Meyer is professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. He's author of several books, including In the Fullness of Time, and he's also authored Our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for April, called The Very First Easter. Now, when we come back from this break, I'll tell you how you can get these two books, both The Fullness of Time and The Very First Easter, so stay tuned. Also, after the break, we'll be talking with Dr. Judith Reisman. We'll get an update on the Kinsey Institute. It has suffered from some real accurate historical investigation work into what Kinsey was up to when he wrote his sex reports, the male and the female. And they're trying to revive his reputation now, 50 years later. The death of Jesus is, to all outward appearances, an ordinary death at this time in Roman history. Maybe he dies a little quick, but he had suffered this punishment. But Jesus tells us in advance what is really going on. He says, I lay down my life for the sheep. No one takes my life from me. I lay it down of my own accord that I may take it up again. And that's what we'll talk about next time with Dr. Paul Meyer. We'll be right back.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc. Is the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ historically reliable? What can we learn about this miraculous event from extra-biblical sources? You'll find answers to these questions with the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for April, The Very First Easter. The book is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this book on our website, issuesetc.org, and click the What's New section, issuesetc.org. The Very First Easter is written by Dr. Paul Meyer, professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University. It's a great Easter gift for your children or your grandchildren. The book costs $12.99 plus shipping and handling. The Very First Easter, Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for April. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. The United States will not introduce a resolution condemning China for human rights abuses at the annual meeting of the UN Human Rights Commission in Geneva. It's only the third time in the last 13 years that such a resolution has not been offered. Steve Jordahl reports.
The U.S. delegation cites senior-level meetings between the U.S. and China that promote what they're calling substantive dialogue between the two countries. Delegation spokesman David Hamill says they're beginning to see some limited progress.
These include China's decision to cooperate with UN mechanisms without conditions. You could also cite their decision to invite the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom to China.
Hamill calls the progress significant, but also acknowledges there's a ways to go.
We've also cited the problems with China's human rights record. In the State Department's human rights report.
Human rights groups say the absence of a resolution shows the U.S. is putting politics in front of human rights concerns. Scott Weinberg of the Population Research Institute doubts that U.N. diplomacy can accomplish anything.
The dialogue typically between the United States and China is one-sided. It's lies from the Chinese and, at best, gullibility from the U.S.
China abuses women through forced sterilization and abortion, and Weinberg says the cruelty continues.
The State Department's recent human rights report in China indicates that one-child policy abuses are even worse than ever before.
Weinberg says the U.S. needs to assert more pressure on China to stop the abuses. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
Some are pointing to the Bush administration's desire to involve China as a partner in resolving mounting tensions with North Korea as an underlying reason for this year's silence. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
On the next Joy, we've been waiting for weeks to take the lid off and celebrate the joy of Easter with Bach, Handel, and an hour bursting with glorious music. It won't be long now. This is Ron Clem. We'll try to contain ourselves, but only if you promise to join us this week for the music of Easter on Joy.
Listen to Joy Sunday afternoon at 4:05 on AM 850 KFUO. Is the death and resurrection of Christ historically reliable? Find out with the new children's book, The Very First Easter, published by Concordia Publishing House. 1-800-325-3040. The Very First Easter is the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April. 1-800-325-3040. You can find out more about this book on the internet, issuesetc.org, and click What's New? The Very First Easter by Dr. Paul Meyer, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April.
We just finished a conversation with Dr. Paul Meyer. He's author of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April called The Very First Easter. Now, this is your last chance to receive our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April before Easter. You can order it any time, of course, but if you want to receive it before Easter, you can get it for your grandchildren, your children, your godchildren as an Easter gift. All you have to do is call Concordia Publishing House in the next 25 minutes, that's before 5 o'clock, at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, and request next day shipping. That is required if you want to receive this great book, The Very First Easter, before Easter as a gift for your kids. 1-800-325-3040. The cost is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040. Remember to request next day shipping. We'll spend the remainder of this hour talking with Judith Reisman. We're getting an update on the Kinsey Institute. Judith Reisman is president of the Institute for Media Education based in Sacramento, California. She's been a consultant for three U.S. Department of Justice administrations, the U.S. Department of Education, as well as the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. She's author of several books, including her latest, Kinsey, Crimes and Consequences. And she's also written a recent column for WorldNetDaily.com titled, Beatifying the Kinsey Institute. Dr. Reisman, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. Delighted to be back.
For those who have only a passing familiarity with Alfred Kinsey and his, or what's been touted as groundbreaking sexual research in the late 40s and 50s. Tell us about him and his research.
Well, Todd, you know, as you certainly know, everyone out there is very familiar with Kinsey. They just don't know, you know, who it was that caused so many changes in their own personal lives, sexually, and in the lives of those that they love. Dr. Kinsey, in 1948, he was a zoologist at Indiana University, and he came out with a book with two colleagues, and it was called Sexual Behavior in the Human Male. That book was credited with kicking off what was called the Sexual Revolution, which I think we're all pretty familiar with by now. And, in fact, it did exactly what it claimed. Dr. Kinsey, or Kinsey, the zoologist, claimed that most of our males, 95% of our males, he said, actually ought to be, if you will, not that he's saying they should be, but he said that, in fact, they were engaged in such bizarre sexual behavior that we called bizarre, that they would be in prison if all of our laws were enforced as we had our laws designed. He said that our fathers and grandfathers and were really a bunch of sexual hypocrites, so were our grandmothers, because in fact that they were engaging in these adventurous sexual activities. They were engaged in adultery. Commonly, that 50% of our males engaged in adultery, that almost 30% of our females engaged in adultery, and most of them wanted to, that prostitution use was absolutely common amongst our males, that 25 or 27% of our wives had abortions, and that 87% of single unmarried females had abortions, that fornication, sex before marriage, was so common that pretty much everybody engaged in it, including our allegedly, you know, virginal young women, and on and on. And, of course, that 10% to 37% of our males were homosexual at some point in time, and that children were sexual from birth. And from this came the claim, therefore, that all of our sex laws needed to be changed, our rape laws needed to be radically altered so that people didn't go to prison for rape, really, that they were pardoned quickly, or you know, just kept in prison for a very short space of time. That from there we developed what's called the American Law Institute Model Penal Code, which brought all of these fraudulent, massively fraudulent claims about grandpa and grandma into the legal system and justified the massive overhaul of our sex laws, so that now we have Amber Alerts and Megan laws and everything else in the world to try to deal with the fact that we have spread pornography, which was obscenity, all over the country, and we have young children acting out on little kids, and we have adults acting out on kids, and we have people raping people, and 58,200 children abducted from our streets in 1999, according to the Department of Justice. And so all of this massive change took place, and you can sit back and take a good look at the founder of that change, who followed a long, long, long line, of course, of sexual revolutionaries, but who really brought it to the fore, and that was the Rockefeller-funded Dr. Alfred Kinsey at the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University, and his colleagues in law, psychiatry, and public policy.
Given the fact that this research is so suspect, from what we know of Kinsey now, from what we know the methods of his research,
mm-hmm.
Is Kinsey still cited as an unimpeachable authority today?
Oh, Todd, yes, absolutely, yes. Until the public becomes aware, and this information is so carefully kept from public view. My book, Kinsey Crimes and Consequences, was written. It wasn't a major publishing house that took this book, even though people were just absolutely positive it would be snatched up and argued over by every major publishing house. Nobody would touch it, because what you're looking at is undermining the whole structure of the sex education establishment, sex education in the school system, which is a whole massive, now funded, well-funded structure, both both from the federal government, state governments, and private foundations. You're looking at the whole pornography industry that is profiting from the sexual dysfunctions of our society. You're looking at massive incomes for the pharmaceutical companies, the abortion industry. So it pretty, and the, of course, the homosexual lobby. So yes, those who are quote leaders in the field continue to quote Kinsey. They simply say that he was, yes, okay, they admit that he was a little bit bizarre. Bizarre is a kind of an understatement. This is a man who, and I'll watch what I'm saying on your program, but this was a man who was so obsessed sexually and so addicted sexually that every definition of this man is that of a sexual psychopath. He tortured himself. I won't go into details. But in ways that led effectively to his early demise. He was so abused, you know, his sexual functions. So, yeah, despite all that, you have such a commitment to the man, and if he goes down, the whole edifice of, quote, human sexuality, like phrenology at the turn of the century, is dramatically crippled, and that's what needs to happen. It needs to happen at every legislative level. It needs to happen in our legal system again. We've got to go gut all of the changes in our laws that made women and children so vulnerable to violence, and we can't do that until we understand the fraud that was perpetrated on this nation.
You have written the article beatifying the Kinsey Institute. What efforts are underway to rebuild the tarnished reputation of Kinsey and his research and the institute that has survived his death?
A great deal of effort, and I should be really clear about it. One of the most important things that I discovered and that started this whole unpinning of Kinsey was the simple fact, really, that his data testified to the fact that he'd been using pedophiles to rape children, sodomize children, as young as 2 months of age. And those people were employed, so to speak. Sometimes money changed hands. Mostly these appears to have been crimes of passion and pleasure on the part of the adults. And these people tortured at least 317, if not 2,035 infants and children. The youngest was 2 months of age. When I say torture, I mean that's exactly what I mean. The children were identified by Kinsey as collapsing and as fainting and as screaming and so forth, and he just called those orgasmic responses. So he was so dramatically undermined with this revelation, which came out of his own work, that the Rockefeller Foundation, which originally funded him, and Ford, kicked in additional money to the monies coming out of Indiana University and the federal government through various mechanisms, kicked in extra money in 1998 to revitalize Kinsey, to bring him back up out of the garbage bin. And right now, Liam Neeson is about to star in a glamorization of Kinsey in a full feature film by Coppola. What's his name? His first name's Coppola Jr.
Francis Ford Coppola.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Francis Ford Coppola Jr. And they're about to do a big feature film with featuring Neeson's wife as Mrs. Kinsey and a whole lot of sort of mainline stars. And they will be glamorizing this man because he is extremely important to the economic and the academic structure of human sexuality in the United States.
Tell us about any, if there are any, legislative efforts to, in some way, overturn the influence of Kinsey's fraudulent research.
Well, there are efforts going on. RSVP America, I can give you an 800 for them too, 1-800-837-0544. RSVP America under Eunice Ray, they've been meeting groups of women and men all over the country to try to bring this information to various legislators. In 1995, we almost got a bill through the federal government on a Child Protection Act, but our key mover and shaker, the congressman on that, a huge moneyed pocketed group came after him immediately after he began this effort, and they defeated him in Texas. And so we haven't had anything hit at the federal level again, but we're always looking for people who are ready to work with us on something like that. That's really what is absolutely necessary.
One of the things that you highlight in your article for WorldNet Daily, beatifying the Kinsey Institute, is the convenient marriage between radical feminism and the person of Gloria Steinem.
Oh, yeah.
And this Kinsey research.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
Well, Gloria Steinem was, interestingly, of course, their very first spokesperson at this is a big celebration this year for Kinsey's 50 years of his sexual behavior in the human female, which was supposed to be such a boon to us all, that is all females. And so Gloria Steinem was their key spokesperson, and she was very distressed that not all of the taboos that Kinsey sought to break down have been broken down, you know, in the way that she feels they ought to have been, although a lot of them have, and I guess she's under the delusion that we've come a long way, baby. You know, we're looking at 58,200 children, as I said, kidnapped off the streets of our nation. This is the United States in 1999, according to the Department of Justice, and a large proportion, most of those were girls. I don't know that those little girls would agree with Gloria that we've come a long way, baby, you know, nor the massive increase in venereal disease amongst our young women, nor their early demise because of those infections early on, nor the increase in illegitimacy that these children are being carried in by single moms who then spend a lifetime trying to raise them without a husband, and so on and so on. I mean, the list of benighted experiences for women is unrelenting, not to mention the fact that they are now expected to engage in the most bizarre behaviors in order to attract a male, much less to get marriage on the mind. So Gloria's upset that not all taboos have been broken. And indeed, although the American Psychiatric Association has no longer identified pedophilia as a mental problem, unless the person who wants to have sex with children feels guilty about it, and although the American Psychological Association is kind of wishy-washily falling in line, we haven't said yet that children were totally viable for adults, although the campaign is well underway. And with Mr. Polanski winning, you know, a big Academy Award last year, my thought, of course, is that the Kinsey film is slated for an Academy Award effort in the upcoming year as well. So the promotion of pedophilia and pederasty is not just by any means in a Catholic church. That's not just a Catholic problem. And it's a problem in all the churches and all the denominations and religious denominations, by the way.
We're talking with Dr. Judith Reisman. She's president of the Institute for Media Education based in Sacramento, California. Now, she has a website as well. It is Dr. Judith Reisman. That is Dr. Judith, Reisman.org. That's Dr. Judith, Reisman.org, drjudithreisman.org, and her phone number 1-800-476-0975 if you'd like to purchase Dr. Reisman's latest book called Kinsey Crimes and Consequences. 1-800-476-0975. That's 1-800-476-0975. Dr. Reisman, you know, we've talked about this before, and the details of Kinsey's research are horrifying.
Oh, yes.
On the one hand, we have a culture that is deeply distressed when children are abducted, when sexual crimes are committed here, mm-hmm. and we wonder, how did we get to this point? Mm-hmm. And yet, on the other hand, we have a culture that is more than willing to at least consider some of these things not to be crimes. Mm-hmm. How in the world have we become schizophrenic on these issues that seem to be so clear-cut?
Well, I don't think, you know, first of all, we were not schizophrenic. When Kinsey's research came out, most common, regular, ordinary Americans thought he was full of baloney. Nobody, you know, there weren't many people who believed him, but our elites did. A large percentage of our professorial class and our elite class, the folks, the real smart guys, you know, they were quick to believe, and many of them quick to catch on. It freed them from any kind of legal or ethical obligations, you see. And so they began teaching that in their classrooms. Now, Mom and Dad were paying the $20,000 or $30,000 to send little Johnny and little Janie to college to get this higher education that Mom and Dad hadn't had while they were busy working their, you know, themselves to a frazzle-dazzle, you know, to give them a good life. And Jane and Johnny went to college, and we're told by Professor, you know, Smith and Professor Jones that Mom and Dad were a bunch of hypocrites, didn't know what they were talking about, really were engaged in all this sort of the graduate kind of sexual activity behind their backs, and in fact that none of that was harmful, and it was just their uptight religious background that was causing Mom and Dad, you know, to deny and to lie. So little John and Janie then became, in 1948, the experimental class, and by the time, you know, you're looking at 1960s, the impact of Kinsey's influence on the elites who then taught the children at the university level, and boy, we're talking about Harvard and Yale, and, you know, I mean, at the top of the line, those folks then became the new leaders to the teachers who went into our classrooms, too, and who began to lead the sexual revolution right and left, because they had learned that Mom and Dad were lying to them all the time. The big word at that time was hypocrites. Mom and Dad were hypocrites. And Mom and Dad were by no means skilled enough or knowledgeable enough about the fraud being perpetrated on their lives, about the libel that they were experiencing against them and their parents, to be able to answer these challenges when their children came home from the big smarts, you know, colleges, and told them that they knew it all. So these kids became our lawyers, they've become our judges, they've become our doctors, they've become our legislators, and as a result, yes, we are where we are today, having to try to re-educate two generations that were raised on the Kinsey fraud, and that's not easy. But it's, you know, look, this is a can-do nation. It's always possible.
I almost hesitate to ask this because I'd hate to hear more bad news on top of the fact that Kinsey's still being authoritatively cited, but are there any researchers, reputable or otherwise, who are attempting to build upon Alfred Kinsey's research?
Well, there are many, yes, of course. I mean, Masterson Johnson came right after Kinsey. Well, reputable, I can't say reputable.
I use that in quotations.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, all the entire field of human sexuality education stands on Kinsey's fraud. Essentially, there were three centers of training that came out of that. One in San Francisco, the New York University, of course, and also a University of Pennsylvania. And they began to create coursework in this quote-unquote field and to create their own new discipline, and from this new discipline we get all these bizarre people who spread out all across the country. Right now we're dealing with Kansas. University of Kansas has a course in which a man named Dennis Daly, Professor Daly, has been you know, teaching, quote, human sexuality, he said, for 20 years, coming out of no training initially, but I guess, you know, going to these little courses and conferences and whatnot, and he's been teaching the same material, and recently has gotten sort of a real slap from Senator Susan Weigel of Kansas, in which she says, "How come he's showing pictures of children, in you know, young children's genitalia, in his sex class, with all of the giggling and all of the other kinds of erotic stuff going on over there? This isn't a medical, you know, course." And he, of course, justifies everything that he's doing on the basis of the need to take these children who come into his class and to rid them of their Judeo-Christian belief systems, which, of course, he feels are entirely inappropriate for educated people. So this kind of thing that he has been carrying on, or the what's called the queering of the schools, the teaching of children, you know, teaching children bisexual and homosexual activity as part of their ABCs, is sort of ABC, H, and, you know, maybe B's for bisexuality, and now we go up to H. I don't know. and identifying the masturbatory activity as something that we all ought to and must engage in, otherwise we're going to die. You know, it's interesting because pre-Kinsey, you know, they charge that the parents were telling children, well, if you do that, you're going to be sick and you're going to die. Now they tell them, if you don't, you're going to be, you know, you'll die. So all of this sort of, well, it's not die necessarily, but all of this sort of thing can be identified, again, as based on fraud. It is fraud. It was perpetuated on this nation by a group of radical sexual revolutionaries. I'm not suggesting they were the first to be sexual revolutionaries. We've had philosophers and we've had, all sorts of so-called educated people in literature and so forth for many hundreds of years who have wanted to be able to do anything they wanted to do without anybody condemning them. And it finally kind of came about through the fraud of Kinsey and his so-called science.
Dr. Judith Reisman, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you, and I want everybody out there, please, to either go to the website and order books from there, because I'm not here to entertain you. I'm here to get you to understand where to get the information, and or call and get those books and get them circulated.
Dr. Judith Reisman is president of the Institute for Media Education based in Sacramento, California. She's been a consultant for three U.S. Department of Justice administrations, the U.S. Department of Education, as well as the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. She's author of several books, including her latest called Kinsey, Crimes and Consequences. You can purchase this book, Kinsey, Crimes and Consequences, by calling 1-800-476-0975. That's 1-800-476-0975. The book is called Kinsey, Crimes and Consequences, 1-800-476-0975, or you can check out her website by visiting drjudithreisman.org. That's Dr. Judith Reisman, Reisman.org. In the next hour of the program, we're going to be talking with Dr. Peter Scare of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. The upper room on the night when Jesus was betrayed. What took place there? If you would open your Bibles as in advance of that program, to the 22nd chapter of the Gospel of Luke. That is where we will visit in the next hour of Issues, Etc. Feel free to give us a call in that last hour, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Peter Scare is next as we talk about the upper room. What happened there? The Last Supper? There are certain things that happened that we very seldom discuss. What was Jesus doing with his disciples in his last hours before his betrayal and his arrest? We'll be right back after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.